Coming up next on 94.7 WTVC LP Charlottesville, it's Apropos of Something, co-hosted by Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence. Apropos of Something welcomes experts, activists, and the marginalized from our community to discuss how the latest policies are affecting everyday people. Apropos of Something is brought to you by the Beckham team at Keller Williams. And now, here's Ellen.
To Apropos of Something, you're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, Resistance Radio, and I like to say Persistence Radio. Apropos of Something airs live every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence from our studio in New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts, and we guarantee every show will be apropos of something. Today, we are very lucky to have back with us Meredith Clark, Assistant Professor of Media Studies at the University of Virginia. Her scholarship focuses on the intersections of race, media, and power. She's currently writing a book on Black Twitter. We also have on the show award-winning author Preston Lauterbach. His new book is Bluff City, The Secret Life of Photographer Ernest Withers. It tells the story of civil rights in Memphis in the 60s. Withers captured some of the most iconic images of that time, from the trial of Emmett Till and the sanitation worker strike to showing the history of race and Elvis's musical background, all while working as an FBI informant. My friend, before we get started with that, are you there, Nancy Lawrence?
Ellen, I'm here. I have a question for you because, you know, we rarely communicate during the week.
So, yes, that's not true.
I've been wondering if you two are throwing your hat in the ring. Are you running for the Democratic nomination for president? Everyone is. Are you as well?
The country will be very happy to hear, no, I'm not.
Okay,
Did someone else?
I was going to make room for you in the big cavalcade of
yes.
heads.
Did anyone get in besides Beto?
Anyone else lately? You mean in the last 10 minutes? I haven't updated, speaking of Twitter, I haven't seen what's trending, but probably by Monday there's got to be someone.
Right.
Biden's hanging out. They're all hanging out there. There's more. There's still some left. So I figured you were one of them.
I'm not one of them. It's our loss. I did want to say that our show is now on Apple Podcasts. There's 76 entire episodes with amazing people like the ones we have here, and also on the app Overcast. And I'm going to mention it now. We're going to talk more about it later. But we have a doubleheader next week because in honor of the Virginia Festival of the Book, we are going to have a show, our normal show at 10 to 11, and then taking a break. And then at 12 to 1, two more authors, or another author and another guest.
Yeah. Okay, we'll save the names. This is how we do it, Ellen. We'll save the names for the end of the show.
Yes, and also...
We're just teasing that we have a doubleheader next week.
It's true. And also, on May 2nd, Randy Rainbow is coming to Charlottesville, and we are going to be giving away a pair of tickets. So if you want those tickets, Nancy, what can they do? I think some Twitter action, maybe, or
okay.
Facebook.
I'm on it.
So
I got to go now. I'm on it.
whoever tweets to AOS Radio... or posts on Facebook, or reaches me otherwise for those tickets, they are yours. May 2nd, Randy Rainbow.
That sounds great.
Yeah, don't want to miss it.
That sounds really good, yeah.
So, our first guest is Meredith Clark. We are welcoming her back to the show. She is an assistant professor of media studies at the University of Virginia. She was trained as a journalist working for several publications, including as a contributor to USA Today. TheRoot.com named her as one of the most 100 influential Black Americans on their 2015 Root 100 list. Her work focuses at the intersections of race, media, and power, covering everything from media processes like newsroom hiring and reporting practices to the digital narratives constructed by social media communities. She's focused her scholarship lately, I believe, on Black Twitter and is currently turning that research into a book. Welcome, Meredith.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Yes, so it's great to see you. You've studied Black Twitter since 2010. Tell us Because when you hear Black Twitter, I feel like we don't really know. A lot of us do not know what that means. So how would you define what Black Twitter is?
So I always define Black Twitter as a network of culturally linked communicators using the platform to draw attention to issues of concern to Black communities.
Okay.
Well, should we white-splain it, what it really is now, Meredith?
No, that's good enough.
Apparently right? You don't know.
Well, how is it different?
You came back to the show.
How is it different in reality than what I'm going to call mainstream Twitter?
Well, it's different in a number of ways. First of all, there is this pre-existing community that migrated to Twitter. And I think a lot of people forget that before there was this social networking platform where people could tweet out at that time at 140 characters at a time, there were people who were talking to one another through the comments on their blogs, through some of the other social media spaces they were on, through Black Planet. And we know that Solange Knowles brought that platform back a couple weeks ago. So there was pre-existing community before people came to Twitter. And then one of the differences there is what was called the overrepresentation of Black people on Twitter. And it's just that Black folks in the United States in particular use the platform at higher rates than other groups.
Is it, in this time since you've been studying it, is it making the impact you envisioned? Is it doing what you want it to be doing?
Well, you know, in studying Black Twitter, I can't say that there's something in specific that I would want to see the communities there do other than draw attention to the multiplicity of Blackness, the way that you can be Black in so many different ways. And I think that in the conversations that are held there, in the campaigns that emerge out of the space, that is being done very well.
And you write a paper on social protests. So how does this fit in, and what have you learned in studying social media as protest?
So there are a couple of papers that we've written out of it. Most of them I've collaborated with other authors on. One of the big studies was Beyond the Hashtags, which was published in 2015, early 2016, with Dean Freelon out of UNC Chapel Hill and Charlton McElwain from NYU. And we learned a lot about how Black Twitter was essential to building up Black Lives Matter as a social media fueled social movement. So again, going back to these connections that existed before there was a hashtag, where people were talking about racial justice, they were talking about police reform, they were talking about over-criminalization of Black communities, and then they had a hashtag to coalesce around and to help organize themselves around. So those are some of the things that some of the earlier work that I've done on Black Twitter and protest has yielded.
And I guess I don't mean to generalize, so I'm not. Do hashtags work in terms of bringing attention to the mainstream, which is usually white, I confess. So do those hashtags break through enough? Do they work?
I think we can look at the success of the Black Lives Matter movement, and excuse me, the movement for Black Lives, because there is a difference. You can look at the success of that movement of hashtag campaigns like Oscar So White and name a number of individuals for whom we held hashtag memorials and see exactly how effective that technological affordance is in piercing news media agendas and getting people to pay attention to things that they otherwise might not know about. So I'd say yes.
So what are some of the stories or the events that people have rallied around, and those that would have had hashtags, for instance?
Sure. So one of the ones that I think is that might be somewhat known to the listening audience is the Mute R. Kelly hashtag. That hashtag developed as a specific campaign. It has a website. It has a long backstory. But one that people may not know as much about is a predecessor called Fast Tail Girls. And that was created back in 2014, or 2013, to talk about the hypersexualization of Black girls and how they're often blamed for being preyed upon by Black men within our communities. And so those hashtags have worked together over time, really, to draw attention both to the issue of how a predator like R. Kelly is allowed to move and operate with impunity in Black communities, and how complicit there are other people, family members, friends, church members, folks who, instead of holding grown men responsible for their actions, turn and place blame on young girls who are just coming into maturity and who do not have the same sort of agency.
Do you feel as well that the police brutality has broken through, like stories like Botham Jean and Stefan Clark? Do you feel like we're getting more of that out there?
I do. I also see and am watching people deal with a certain sense of fatigue, fatigue from trauma, from seeing these people killed or hearing the stories about how they were killed and getting all of these brutal details, and then following these cases through the judicial system that's supposed to be working equally and fairly for all of us, and seeing how again and again officers are not indicted, or when they are tried, they are acquitted. They are not held responsible for taking the life of Black people in our communities. So yes, you definitely see those cases kind of rise to the surface. Folks know that people are paying attention. So even though the names have faded from print and online news, we're still talking about them in online spaces. And we will continue to do so.
Are you hopeful about voter suppression, which was, you know, obvious, was made even more apparent again in 2018, but there's always 2020, et cetera. So what are your feelings about voter suppression hitting Twitter?
I can't say that I'm particularly hopeful, just having seen what happened specifically in the state of Georgia with Stacey Abrams' run for governor and Kemp not recusing himself from his office as Secretary of State at the time. The multiple levels on which we have seen voter suppression carried out in this country within certainly my lifetime and before my lifetime. What I am hopeful about is that we are drawing more attention to the issue, that people are using digital platforms in addition to the platforms that they were using before to develop strategy, to organize, and to say that this is one of the things that we need to pay attention to. This has happened most recently in Florida, the state capital of Florida, where Amendment 4, which restored the voting rights of convicted felons who had served out their times, or ex-felons who had served out their time, that's supposed to be restored with just a few steps, and the government is not fulfilling its responsibility to the people of Florida by allowing that amendment to really take effect. And so you see people organized there, and those are the sort of things that make me hopeful.
When you want to voice your concern, and there are many to be voiced these days and probably as always, Twitter is probably the place you first go. Are there other places, or is that the way you communicate what you want? Other than, I guess, you're teaching a class, let's not forget, and you've written papers. So I guess as far as social media, is that the place you go, and are there others that I didn't mention?
It depends. So having started out as a journalist, even before I was hired professionally, writing was always my way of coping with whatever pressure or injustice I was facing at the time, whatever issue that I cared about. So I try to sort things out in my mind and on the page before I take them to social media. And I'm specifically cautious with that because now you see so many people digging up tweets and using them out of context. Social media and digital spaces have never been safe spaces, and I think that's something to remember. So when I bring my thoughts to my timeline, I have been thinking about them for a while. I have thought about exactly what I want to say, and the message that I put out there, even though sometimes they seem very raw and rough, that's something that I've put a good deal of thought behind.
Speaking of that, I was wondering, actually, Meredith, what you thought about, for the most part, it seems like Twitter is definitely in real time, you know, as in immediate. So what is your feeling about the upside and the downside of reacting before we know everything or thinking about it, as you put it?
I think it's the same for me. Coming from a media background and having seen these cycles play out in different ways before we had social media, in the same way that news media would jump to be the first to tell a story, whether that was in print or on the air, we see the same thing being played out just on a much bigger level. So with individuals who can witness something as it unfolds, point a camera at it, and instantly upload and share that video or that audio with an audience that algorithmically could figure in the thousands or even millions. It's not anything new. I think that what is needed now more than ever is just a sense of caution about what you're seeing and what you're hearing, where it comes from, and the context around it. So when we talk about media literacy, these are some of the literacies that I think about. How are you processing information, and are you considering it with any degree of skepticism when you see it?
Do other communities have an equivalent to Black Twitter? And I was wondering if there's a Black Instagram or other platforms.
Mm. So I tend to stay in my lane with Black Twitter. There are different communities that are organized around racial, ethnic, and cultural commonalities. One of the reports that I contributed to that was published last year by the Knight Foundation talked about some of those communities. So we focused on Black Twitter, Asian American Twitter, and feminist Twitter. We were not able to find a researcher to collaborate with us around Latinx Twitter. And that was both interesting and painful because we want to make sure that that representation is there. So yes, there are other communities, and I try not to use the word other, but there are similarly formed communities on these platforms. Now, is there a Black Instagram? I honestly cannot say. But the platform itself is growing in popularity with users of color, and it's one of the places where people always ask, what's next after Twitter? I think the move to more visual media, the way that you're seeing more people pick up Instagram, use Instagram, and connect on Instagram, is definitely one of the next places that you'll see the same kind of explosion of popularity.
What do you think about, you know, speaking of these, of all communities, just the effect of bots or as you said, like being skeptical of news that's presented in terms of, as I heard what you were saying, in terms of like the source that's generating it. So I'll keep it to bots. How do you deal with that, or what's the effect of that, them?
Well, you know, one of the effects that we're talking about right now is the 2016 election in and of itself. There have been a number of reports that have come out that scientists, that folks who do big data science, folks that do computer and information science, are saying there were strategic mechanisms put in place by bad faith actors to split Americans along racial lines. That these individuals at bot farms and troll farms in the United States and in Russia conspired to focus on our fault lines to divide us. And I am just, you know, I have to shake my head, because in 2013 and 2014, women who were within Black Twitter, who were self-identified as Black feminists, started pointing out some of those accounts and saying, something is not right here. These people don't have real profile photos. We've never seen them engage before. And that goes back to those relationships, having these pre-existing relationships. They don't use African-American vernacular English properly. Like, it has a form. It has a style. It has conventions. They're doing a really bad job of faking being Black. And I just think about what might have happened if people had taken those women seriously in 2014. Where might we be now?
Mm-hmm. That's such an interesting topic, the whole bot thing. So I'm glad you asked that, Nancy. So we're going to go to a hard break. We're going to be right back with Meredith Clark, professor of media studies at the University of Virginia. We're talking about Black Twitter and social media, race and power. Also, after the break, in a bit, we're going to be speaking with Preston Lauterbach. His new book is Bluff City. Stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Apropos of Something. We air every Saturday morning live from 10 to 11. I'm here. I'm Ellen Daniels with my co-host, Nancy Lawrence. We're speaking with Meredith Clark. And in a bit, we're going to be speaking with Preston Lauterbach.
Yes. Oh, let me
cue Nancy
right there. Meredith, about All the Black Twitter. We've been chatting with you on your, as Ellen has mentioned earlier, you're writing a book, which one of the chapters will be on Black Twitter. So what in the, what's going in the book regarding Black Twitter?
So the whole book is about Black Twitter.
Excuse me.
No worries.
Well, you should have definitely asked the question.
No worries at all. So the book starts actually with a critique of media processes, news media processes in particular. And I think it's essential to understand how Black communities in particular have been marginalized by mainstream news media for so long. So the Kerner Commission report celebrated its 50th anniversary last year. And that report was commissioned by President Lyndon B. Johnson after race riots in 1967 across the country. And he asked three questions: what happened, why did it happen, and how do we keep it from happening again? And in one section of the report, there was an implication for mainstream news media, and they needed to include Black professionals in reporting on Black communities, and they needed to do a better job in reporting on Black communities. Well, I run something called the American Society of News Editors Annual Newsroom Diversity Survey, which has been tracking numbers of racial and gender representation in America's newsrooms, print and digital, for the last 40 years. And we find that those numbers haven't grown, and they certainly haven't grown in a way that keeps pace with the population of the United States. So you've got this big gap between who is able to create media and who consumes media. And then you have the emergence of internet technology and mobile technology that allows everyone who has connections to the internet and the tools to use them to become publishers in and of themselves. So that's where the book starts, and it proceeds through a number of chapters to talk about, one, how Black women are Black Twitter's locomotive power. It is framed from a Black feminist epistemology. It talks about the framework that allowed Black Lives Matter to take off the way that it did. It talks about the humor that Black Twitter uses in every day, from just having fun to coping and using it as a mechanism of collective grief. And it closes with some suggestions for really dismantling systems of white supremacy in mainstream news media and rebuilding in a way that is more just and more inclusive.
You know, you just reminded me, and I don't know enough about this either, but every so often it is a news, it's in the news just how the government or organization, you know, corporations are making the internet very difficult for poor communities, for, you know, disadvantaged places to get access to the internet. And you're just reminding me of just how it, how behind the eight ball you can get before you, you know, you're even in school. And I don't know if you have numbers on that, but I'm sorry, you're just reminding me of just the, don't take, you know, taking for granted the access to the internet that I do, you know, that not everyone has.
Absolutely. Not everyone has it. It's one of the things that when I talk about Black Twitter, I am mindful to say Black Twitter is not Black America, and you can't consider it as representative of Black America because, one, it's a specific subsection. It's people who have access to the internet, have the tools to use it, and have the time to use it to be on this platform and to connect with others. But then there are so many people who do not have that access. My colleague at UVA in the Department of Media Studies, Chris Ali, does amazing work on the need for broadband policy that governs how people in rural areas get access to internet technology. And UVA is going to be part of an initiative that focuses on public interest technology, making sure that we have policy, media policy in place that seeks to serve the needs of the public when it comes to the technologies that are being developed and used, making sure that people have access, have ability, and have rights in those spaces.
I know that you're going to be teaching a new class called Documenting the Now. Can you talk about that project?
Yes. So Documenting the Now is the project itself. The class, which will be MDST 3. 4559. So registration is coming up in a couple of weeks.
Yes, it is. I think the classes were just listed yesterday.
Yeah. The class is called Media Memory and Technology, and we are using the tools from Documenting the Now, which is an initiative to help people do digital archiving around social justice projects. We're using those tools to create archives of social justice projects, some of the ones that people may not have heard of, that haven't bubbled up in national news media, but are very important to small, localized communities. And so I am looking forward to collaborating with students. It's going to be a smaller group, about 20 students. We're going to figure out what we want to make sure people do not forget about 20 and 30 years from now. So when Twitter is no more, when Instagram is no more, when we still have the internet and we still have technologies and ways of communicating, that we have kept for the record what happened, who was involved, and what forces were at work. I think it's important in the corollary is now going back and looking at the papers of women who were quote unquote overlooked. You've seen the New York Times do this series of obituaries of women and people of color, people on the margins, and saying that they were overlooked. And those people weren't overlooked. They were ignored. And so we want to make sure that that doesn't happen with digital texts. And so that's what the course is going to focus on.
The same pattern of who's in charge of recording history applies to the internet is what I'm hearing. Is that fair to say that that's part of what you're making sure doesn't happen again? The access
Yes.
to all that. Right?
Absolutely. I mean, the technologies evolve, but the problems evolve with them, and inequalities will remain as long as we keep replicating these systems. So if we're going to be facing some of the same problems, and we're seeing some of them now, we need to think about better solutions, and hopefully we start getting in front of some of those problems with our solutions.
I wanted to mention people can follow you on Twitter, at Meredith Clark. I believe, is there a D there?
There is a D.
Okay, Meredith D. Clark.
Yes.
I'm sure there's a bunch of Meredith Clarks.
There actually are. There are two of us that battled it out for that name.
Really?
And she's also in journalism, actually, Meredith Clark. So a lovely person and a great writer, yes.
Okay. But I wanted to ask you this last question, if I may. I'm very moved by your work and what you're doing. I think it's really important. Who or what was your inspiration in getting into this field or your career?
There were a few. So learning about Ida B. Wells when I was a kid, Ida B. Wells remains my patroness. I think about the work that she did at the time that she did and risking her life to use journalism to draw attention to things that American history and at the time people in power would rather ignore. So bringing lynching to the forefront and making sure that it was included in our history and that we knew exactly how brutal it was. So certainly Ida B. Wells, and then growing up in my own community in Lexington, Kentucky, at the time, we had a black columnist named Merlene Davis, and seeing Miss Merlene's face in the paper every week was inspiration to me. They say that you cannot be what you cannot see. And that is so true. I did not think that a journalism career would be possible until I saw other Black women doing it. The only other thing that drives me is making sure that where there is a record being kept, and I think about journalism not as the first draft of history, but the first draft of historical fiction, because it all depends on who's telling it, making sure that the stories of Black people are told accurately, fairly, and in a way that's culturally competent. So those are the forces that drive me.
Thank you so much for being here, Meredith Clark.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, if anyone's going to be in charge of documenting the now, that was an amazing answer. We're really lucky you're taking this on. So thank you for that, too.
So please come back.
Definitely.
Okay, good, good. We'll make it 3 times. Looking forward to that and hearing about how your book is progressing and all the things that you're doing. Thank you again.
Hope by next time it's finished.
Yes. Good. Me too. So, Nancy, do you have a news of note for us today?
I do. I have one. I have one that with a familiar intro since this administration started. A federal court has ruled that an Obama-era regulation designed, in this case, to ensure that children of color are not disproportionately punished or sent to special ed classrooms must take effect immediately, because apparently for the last 2 years, Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos has been delaying its implementation. There are just apparently 2% of the districts nationwide are claiming problems with disparities. And when the Obama administration was in charge, they looked at that number and thought that, you know, things are not being recorded accurately. There's too much leeway in the system. So they had issued this significant disproportionality rule, which requires states to clearly identify the problems in their school systems, and Betsy DeVos has been trying to avoid this for 2 years. So under this rule, special ed fund, it all depends, you know, special ed education funds will now help all schools that are suffering from this improve, reversing systemic racial discrimination.
That's amazing. I'm really glad. Some good news came through. So just a little stuff going on here in the studio. I have a news of note. You ready for
it? Cool. So you're doing two things at once, putting out a fire.
I'm doing
and
many, many, so many plates are spinning. So Maine's last holdout in the state, Skowhegan, voted to end the use of Indians as a nickname and a mascot for its high school sports team a week ago. And the tribe, let's see if I can get this right. Penobscot Nation has been very outspoken to make that happen. And recently, there was some backlash just a couple of days ago, of course, but it is not likely to affect their vote if the school board had voted to end the use of that name. So that made me happy.
That sounds good. How's the plate spinning?
How is the plate spinning?
Do you need more filler? Are we all right?
Yeah, I needed some filler.
You do? All right.
Not much. Not much.
Okay.
This defines our relationship. I tell Nancy how much time she has to talk to me as I'm driving somewhere, and she complies. I think we're good.
Oh, there you go. See?
So
Segue solved.
I feel like we need some theme music here for each guest. You know, just add something to do. Each guest should get their own theme.
For you to manage
something else.
Excellent. Make it a live orchestra. Why don't you get that going over there?
We'll get John Dearth back and he'll do some jazz. So with no further ado, our next guest is Preston Lauterbach. He's an award-winning author, and he wrote Beale Street Dynasty as well as The Chitlin Circuit. And the last book was a Wall Street Journal, Boston Globe, and NPR Book of the Year. He's a former visiting scholar at Rhodes College and fellow at the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. His new book, which we're going to talk all about, is Bluff City, The Secret Life of Photographer Ernest Withers. And I just wanted to quote one of the many favorable reviews Ed Ward for Financial Times says about the book. Bluff City does a masterful job of telling the story of civil rights in Memphis in the 60s, framing it with Withers' biography and culminating with the sanitation workers' strike that would bring King to town and to his death. Not only is it a great narrative, it's also a reminder in these polarized times that moral complexity is baked into human affairs and that sometimes people do the wrong thing for what they perceive is the right reason. Welcome to the show, Preston.
Thank you.
So, you know, first I want to say, you know, did he do the wrong thing for the right reason? But before that, I just wanted to ask you a little bit of background about the book. Why did you write this book, and what story were you trying to tell?
Well, I came to Memphis, Tennessee, which is a really fascinating place, as an outsider, and got really hooked on the culture, particularly on Beale Street, which is full of fascinating figures over its long history, from Robert Church, the South's first black millionaire, to Ida B. Wells, who Meredith mentioned earlier as a groundbreaking journalist, to W.C. Handy, the inventor of blues music, on up through B.B. King, Elvis Presley, Dr. King, and so that was really my bag, was Beale Street culture. And in looking at it from the time of the rise of Elvis to the death of Dr. King, two massive Richter scale historical events that took place in, you know, a kind of flyover town and in a relatively brief period of time, I wanted to find, well, you know, I want people to buy the book, so I can't go too hard and too heavy at it. I have to find one compelling, charismatic character who can lead the way through all of that. And Ernest Withers emerged as my research as that man. He was a media producer, a photojournalist, African-American who worked for the black press from Jet and Ebony magazine in Chicago all the way to the Chicago Defender network of newspapers. He was everywhere covering the race beat in the South in the 50s and 60s. And so he was a witness to all of these tremendous events, as well as a participant in a more secretive way. And so telling those two stories of how he became the key photojournalist on the scene and how this also led to his work as a secret FBI informant, obviously that's a little bit interesting, so I decided to get into it.
Well, I was going to ask you a question, but I know it will be the worst time to ask because I know Ellen wants to cut to a commercial, so I'm not going to do that.
The suspense is killing me. So, yeah, we're going to go to a hard break right now. We'll be right back with Preston Lauterbach. Stay tuned. This is Apropos of Something, and you're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Welcome back, everyone. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Apropos of Something. I just want to tell everyone, I just got a text from the Caribbean. My friend who is there in the Peace Corps just wanted to correct my pronunciation of who she's from Maine, or she spent a lot of time in Maine and happens to know it's Skowhegan and not whatever I said. So thank you for that. And shout out to you, all your people in the West Indies. Nancy?
We're global. Yes, I do have a question for you, Preston.
Okay.
I understand that that Ernest Withers was on the FBI's radar to do this counterintelligence stuff, but for the civil rights during the civil rights movement. But how did he get on their radar? Who had he photographed? Who had he photographed? How did he get there?
Well, that's a really good question. I think as a media member who had access to interesting people and important events, he was one of many journalists whom the FBI reached out to, both black and white, during this time. So media people and media sources are always of value to intelligence agencies. Intelligence agencies gather a lot of their information from the newspaper. Tons of FBI and CIA reports are simply gleaned from journalistic efforts. And so those people who are out there collecting information on the front lines are acting as intelligence gatherers anyway. Now, you take Withers being on the scene of so many important civil rights cases, from the Emmett Till trial to the Montgomery bus boycott, you know, which elevated Dr. King to great prominence in 1956, to the Little Rock Nine case, the integration of Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas in 1957. He's everywhere that they need to be. And so he quite naturally, I think, appealed to them. And he functioned as well as a community sounding board for the FBI. So he was kind of the voice of Beale Street for the Bureau. And so he not only had an in with several important national figures and a perspective on important national events, he was also prominent and trusted in the community, and so was valuable to the Bureau as an interpreter of local events. And so those two elements of Withers' life made him valuable as an asset to the Bureau.
So can you talk about the involvement and what was going on? So, you know, your interpretation of what the FBI wanted and what his participation was.
Well, and it's important to reflect a little bit on the previous question as well while addressing this one. It's important to understand the context in which Withers became involved with the Bureau. We all look at the Bureau in the 60s and the civil rights movement as being enemies because of what we know now. At the time of the mid-50s and the early 60s, there was and this is the time that Withers became involved, there was, I would say, at least a moment, an opportunity of optimism with regard to the feds and the civil rights movement. You look at the way that local law enforcement in the South treated civil rights protests, civil rights activities, not favorably or sympathetically at all, but as the feds showed, particularly on into the Kennedy administration, the feds could be pressured, be pushed into being supportive, or at least doing the bare minimum to protect black citizens' rights. And so The feds were the only game in town with regard to legal protection for civil rights activities. And Withers was there as a witness. He was in Mississippi in 1955 when there was absolutely no federal interest in the Emmett Till case, while that was a miscarriage of justice. He was there in Little Rock when he saw an important evolution when President Eisenhower called out the 101st Airborne, mighty federal power, to integrate the school. And he was in a lesser-known case that's called Tent City, which was a voter suppression, massive voter suppression case in two rural counties near Memphis that African-American journalists, in partnership with the federal government, exposed and actually brought federal charges against these election commissions that had conspired to deprive African-Americans from registering and casting their votes in elections. And so, in that particular case, Tent City is actually what influenced Attorney General Robert Kennedy and President John Kennedy in developing their civil rights agenda as being a primarily voting rights pursuit. So you can see in that particular evolution that there were some opportunities to at least feel good about federal participation. And I don't think Mr. Withers was so naive, nor should we be so naive to think that the FBI was going to be the cavalry in white hats that were going to ride in and save the day. But of the available options, they certainly offered the best opportunity to do right. Now, you don't get involved with the FBI and not get into it up to your neck, and that certainly happened to Mr. Withers as well.
Did he have a side? Was he on the Martin Luther King, the peace side? Was he with Black Power? Did he have an opinion about that?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, and that influenced the way that he reported to the FBI. So he was what you would call an old guard civil rights activist, NAACP, which meant professional, certainly nonviolent. The legal strategy, you look at the 1954 triumph of the NAACP in the Brown versus Board of Education case. These were the real influential factors in Withers' civil rights philosophy. Any kind of communist radicals, rabble-rousing, any kind of threats of violence from within the movement now, he would consider those threatening. And so he really wanted to be on the front line. And look, you asked why he was attractive to them or why he was sought out. As an NAACP man in Memphis, he was one of many NAACP members, and in fact, every executive on the Memphis NAACP talked to the feds. A journalist named Simeon Booker out of Washington, D.C. said, "We all talked to the feds. We had to." And so Withers came from that background of being conservative, old guard, against any kind of influence of communism, any kind of radicalism, any kind of violence. And so when it came to the Black Power movement, that ended up being the major case of Withers' career. When the Black Power movement gained prominence in Memphis, he was right there he couldn't infiltrate them because he was older. He couldn't really become a member of the Black Power movement. That would have looked wrong. But he was sympathetic. He opened the doors of his studio to the Black Power activists. He let them hang out. He talked with them. He listened to them. And he passed those details on to the FBI.
I want to talk a little bit about the specific photos that are so iconic, those mm-hmm. images. And the first one I want to talk about is Emmett Till. And I just think it's so important and so relevant right now. Reverend Jesse Jackson had said that Emmett's murder broke the emotional chains of Jim Crow and sparked a new phase of the civil rights movement. And
right. And
that photo was so iconic. Can you tell us about that?
Well, in terms of Withers' moment in history, so Emmett Till was a rallying point, a major rallying point that I think brought about a new intensity and simple focus of commitment to the civil rights movement in 1954 when that murder took place because of the image of that boy in his casket. And so Withers did not take that picture. I want to be clear about
right.
that. But that image, I think, vaulted the importance and the power of image to a new level, a new prominence in telling the story of civil rights. And so Withers, as a Southern photographer, stepped in at a very key moment when that image was really influencing people. And so at the trial of Emmett Till's murderers,
can we just back up just slightly?
Sure.
Just to say, if people don't know, because we were not really taught this. Okay, let's just put that out there. We weren't taught. A lot of people don't know about the case. So, and I have limited knowledge, too, so I'm just admitting that. But I just when you read about it, could you just tell us about the case, is what I'm getting
at? Yeah, sure. So Emmett Till was a 14-year-old child who lived in Chicago but had family in Mississippi in a rural county in the Delta. He would go and visit this family during the summers, and did so in the summer of 1955. He was, while on this visit to Mississippi, was murdered, and his body was sunk, was tied to a cotton gin fan, a heavy piece of agricultural equipment, and sunk into the Tallahatchie River. But I believe his body broke loose or was otherwise discovered, and so that... His body was in, you know, a terrible state after being murdered and sunk in the river. And his mother, instead of, and, you know, this is kind of interesting, too, the state of Mississippi wanted to bury him. In fact, they put a seal on his coffin. They closed his coffin. They didn't want this child's body being viewed, being seen. They understood the power, the visual power of his remains. His mother, you know, did one of the most courageous things that I can imagine. In her grief, she had the presence of mind to understand the power of the way her son looked, and she said, "No, I want there to be an open casket funeral. I want the world to see what they have done to my boy." And she allowed a photographer from Jet Magazine into his autopsy, where photographs of the child's brutalized remains were then published. And so that is the image that infuriated people across the map. That really became the appearance of that 14-year-old child who'd been tortured, murdered, and sunk in the river. That image got, you know, was circulated through the African-American media, you know, the predecessor of Black Twitter. And it served as a major rallying point. NAACP chapters around the country seized on that and said, we have to get together, we have to push. You saw from there various, you know, other activities that took place immediately in the wake of Emmett Till's appearance in Jet Magazine and in Black papers across the country. So here the power of image has never been more important. Ernest Withers is the independent Black photojournalist in the South, and so he ends up with his camera telling so many important stories at just the right time. So in terms of, you know, access and representation, I mean, he was the man telling the story visually. And he took a key photo at the trial of Emmett Till's killers. It was dangerous for an African-American person to identify or to accuse white people of having done anything in Mississippi at that time. And so Withers was, this is kind of a funny story in a way, Withers was in the courthouse, very tense atmosphere. The African-American journalist had like a card table, you know. Black journalists from around the country were there to cover this major news event, and they were segregated in the courtroom off to the side. Withers was one of them. The judge told the media, put the media under a no photography order for this particular day of testimony. Well, Emmett Till's uncle Moses Wright, was set to testify, and he was there when the child was taken away from his house. And so Moses Wright extended his finger and pointed it accusingly at one of the white men who was on trial for this crime. And Withers said, "To heck with that, I've got to get this picture." So, I mean, he shot it, despite the fact that the judge had ordered no photography in this case. And so that picture of Moses Wright gesturing, pointing towards one of the white murderers of Emmett Till was one of the breakthrough images of Withers' career that has really endured. And that shows you so much about Withers' moxie, his courage, his character, his resourcefulness. You know, the fact that he did that to capture that particular moment, I think, says a lot about him.
Mm-hmm. He also was the one who caught that, who maybe orchestrated, I know you have opinions on this, the photo of all the Memphis sanitation workers with the I Am a Man signs and the questionable wooden, you know, poles that are sticks that they're attached to. What was the outcome of that protest in terms of him?
Well, you know, that's really the climax of this story. I mean, you have this Memphis sanitation workers strike in the spring of 1968, and Withers makes that iconic image the day of March the 28th, 1968, because Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was coming to town to Memphis to lead a march down Beale Street and up Main Street in support of that strike. Of course, it was designed to be a peaceful, nonviolent demonstration. Instead, it broke out into a riot. Well, the signposts that you see the sanitation workers holding those signs up on were used first as the photo prop by Mr. Withers, but those same signs were also used as instruments of violence in the riot. And so to have and Withers said later on that he was the one who bought the lumber, who sawed up the sticks, who nailed the signs to the sticks. He was essentially a reason that lumber was on site for the march that day. And so for a paid FBI operative to have had his hand in that, you know, it raised some serious questions for me. And that's really what launches the book, is that story and that question of was Mr. Withers, as the key photographer and storyteller of the movement, did he bring those signs and that lumber to the site to make that iconic photograph, or was there a more treacherous intent involved?
Right, because wasn't there also, like, as things happened, like, the whole, was it the FBI that orchestrated the march? Did they sabotage?
Right.
Caused the wedge between,
right.
You know, anyway, so where do you come out on that?
I have no doubt that the FBI was very pleased with the results of that march turning violent. I never found the smoking gun evidence to say that they did it, but it perfectly fit the outcome of what they desired at that particular time. So you're looking at a moment in which Dr. King is getting ready to lead a massive demonstration on Washington, D.C., and everybody from the president through the Congress on down to the Bureau does not want this to take place. And so if they could somehow create either divisions between the various factions of the civil rights movement or discredit Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Enough to halt the momentum of this Washington demonstration, why, the government was all for it, right on up to President Johnson. He didn't want any part of it either. And so the riot, in the short term, it certainly disrupted King's ability to lead that march on Washington. It called his nonviolent leadership into question. Congressmen all came out and they said, well, he can't possibly lead people to Washington. He's not going to keep them peaceful. Well, King decided at that point, I have to lead a makeup demonstration, a makeup march in Memphis to prove that we can do it nonviolently. And that's when he was assassinated. So he never had the chance to prove that he could lead that march on Washington.
I just wanted, as we are finishing the interview, tell us about the parallels between that event and August 2017 in Charlottesville.
You know, it's speaking of the March 28th riot, in March 28th, 1968 riot, just personally, everything in Charlottesville was happening. And I live outside Charlottesville, so I'm plugged into what's going on. But as August 2017 was beginning to take place, I was in the depths of telling this story, and I just saw a lot of parallels, and I had a very bad feeling about what was going to take place out in the streets that day. And, you know, the parallels are that you have what should have been a civil demonstration and instead erupted into violence. And each of those events resulted in a fatality and many other injuries and many and a much broader fallout. But, yeah, I mean, I look at both of them and I see where the state and the elected officials could have certainly done a lot better in advance of those situations in order to prevent the injuries, the deaths, and the fallout which took place.
So we just have to wrap up. I just wanted to thank you for being here. We could talk a really long time. This
My
is a
pleasure.
It's a great book. I didn't finish it, but it was really. It's I love your writing. I love your style, and it's a great story. So I encourage people to get it. And you're going to be at the Virginia Festival of the Book Saturday, March 23rd, next weekend at 10 a.m. at the Jefferson School African American Heritage Center.
That is correct. Yeah, I hope to see you all out there.
Yes. Well, we'll be here interviewing people, but I would love if everyone could go there.
The listening y'all should come out.
Yeah, exactly. So Nance.
Yes.
Thank you. Do you have any last words? We're gonna. It's about 11:17. So
I must deliver those names at least. Susan
yes.
Harness, Karen Bender,
yes.
Leona Sevick, the people on our double show.
That's right. So that we're having a double show next.
And Alex Serretta.
Yes. So stay tuned. This is Apropos of Something. Remember, no one has to do everything, but everyone has to do something. Our music is by Springtide. We'll see you next week. Thanks, everybody. Thank you, Nancy.
Thanks for listening to Apropos of Something this morning on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Show and host Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence each Saturday at 10 for Apropos of Something. Brought to you by the Beckham team at Keller Williams. Show archive can be found at SeavillePodcast.com.